This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Cuban flag flies in Washington as full diplomatic relations are reestablished with Havana. Developing nations in danger of Greek-style debt crisis. Cigarette smoking could be linked to schizophrenia. American Zach Johnson wins the British Open Golf Championship in a thrilling climax. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. A most unusual flag-raising ceremony took place in Washington Monday, this one belonging to Cuba. Its blue, red, and white flag went up outside a newly reestablished embassy, marking the resumption of full diplomatic relations with the United States after a break of 54 years, which started during President John F. Kennedy's administration. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins attended the ceremony outside the Cuban embassy and discuss the mood surrounding the historic event with International Edition's Michael Lippin.
The Cuban embassy is located on 16th Street, and it was a very, very enthusiastic crowd that gathered to watch the flag raising. As the Cuban flag was hoisted outside of the embassy, people chanted, "Viva Cuba, Viva Fidel." It was a very mixed crowd outside. There were diplomats and invited guests that were inside of the grounds at the gated mansion that now serves as the embassy. Outside of the gate, there were well-wishers and a variety of normalization supporters and opponents. Many of them waved signs and banners. Some waved banners that called for an end to the U.S. trade embargo on Cuba. I spoke to some of the onlookers. One man from Cuba praised normalization, but said he was critical of the Castro regime. He said Cubans deserved freedom, freedom to organize, freedom to demonstrate, and freedom to invest. Another onlooker was critical of the Obama administration, saying it had basically turned a blind eye to Cuban injustices. He said it was wrong for the U.S. to make what he called concessions to Cuba when there were human rights concerns. He also said the U.S. should not have been so quick to remove Cuba from its state sponsor of terrorism list.
Well, some of those issues may have come up a few hours later in a meeting between U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Cuban counterpart Bruno Rodriguez. I understand you were at the State Department for that meeting. What were the main points that they made?
Well, they had several main points, and I had an opportunity to ask Foreign Minister Rodriguez if, during his private discussions with Secretary of State Kerry, if they'd set priorities for future talks, and I also asked if he envisioned a political opening in Havana on issues such as greater freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and the legalization of opposition parties. He called these internal matters for Cuba, but he did say that during his talks with Kerry, he emphasized Cuba's desire to have the trade embargo lifted and also the Cuban desire for the return of Guantanamo Bay. Secretary of State Kerry, for his part, said that along the way, as the normalization process between the two countries continues, they are sure to encounter bumps here and there and even what he called moments of frustration. Kerry said that patience would be required, but he said that was all the reason to get started on what he called the journey now.
And did Secretary Kerry give an indication of what policy goal the U.S. wants to achieve first in its relationship with Cuba?
He didn't say what goal he wanted to achieve first. He did mention that they discussed a wide variety of concerns, some of those being human rights concerns that the U.S. has about Cuba. He also spoke about the two-country broadening ties as far as trade and investment is concerned.
VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins speaking earlier with my colleague Michael Lippin. The opening ceremony for the U.S. Embassy in Cuba will be delayed until Secretary Kerry can travel to Havana next month, but the embassy will be fully functional in the meantime. The process of normalizing relations between the United States and Cuba only begins with Monday's formal opening of embassies in Washington and Havana. Both nations still must overcome a legacy of mistrust and legal obstacles to the free flow of information, people, and trade. My colleague Jeffrey Young spoke earlier with analyst Thomas Bilbao of the Washington-based Cuba Study Group and asked him what the United States stands to gain from the new relationship.
Opening embassies puts us in a position to advance U.S. natural interests on the ground in Cuba. It allows our diplomats to have greater contact with civil society on the ground and with diplomatic missions there, and to work with Cuba on a number of bilateral issues that are of mutual interest, like drug interdiction, oil spill mitigation, and terrorist financing.
Tell me about the work that's going to have to be done on Capitol Hill.
Well, while we opened embassies, we know that the embargo is still in place, and that's because that was codified by Congress, and it takes Congress in order to do away with those sanctions. For example, Americans' ability to travel to Cuba for tourism is something that's explicitly prohibited in law. However, there is legislation to do away with that travel those travel restrictions, and there are other legislation in place to expand telecommunications, to wholesale lift the embargo, or to expand trade in different areas. So it will take Congress moving to do away with those sanctions.
You know, for decades, big developers, they've been looking at Cuba and they've had big eyes and a big appetite. All they see is Condo Canyon. All they see is development. How long do you think it's going to take?
I think that what we should concentrate on doing now is helping Cubans start, operate, and grow their businesses and let them be the authors of their future. And I think the United States and the U.S. business can play an important role, but I think that the future of Cuba should be led by the Cuban people, not by us.
What about laws that have to do with property, with investment, with protecting people's development? Every country has to have laws to protect investments. Are Cuba's laws on the books, presently on the books, strong enough to encourage investment and development, or do they need to be beefed up so that Cuba becomes a more attractive place for outside money?
We've already seen that there are foreign investors in Cuba, and Cuba, in fact, redid its foreign investment law last year to try to attract new businesses, and it did attract some, but I think that a lot of companies still have very legitimate concerns, including the ability to hire and manage their own staff, to be able to pay their staff directly, a number of labor concerns, and concerns regarding property and the protection of intellectual property and other things that really will have to be resolved if Cuba hopes to attract the type of foreign investment that it needs to grow its economy to be able to be competitive in the 21st century.
That was Thomas Bilbao, Executive Director of the Cuba Study Group in Washington, speaking to International Edition's Jeffrey Young. U.S. property developers are eager to jump into the Cuban market, but they are not the only businesses interested. VOA business correspondent Alexis Christophorus has more from New York.
There are high hopes on the part of many, many different companies chomping at the bit to get a piece of this newly opened Cuban market. Companies involved in tourism are sure to see a huge boost in business. I'm talking about cruise companies, airlines, even hotel chains that are looking to do business there. But outside of tourism, you've got internet service providers who want to be able to bring their services into Cuba, like Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn. U.S. banks see tremendous opportunity there as they will try to get business from both institutions and individuals. Auto companies also stand to benefit, as does telecommunications companies, which now will be able to create infrastructure in Cuba that will open up a communication pipeline between the two countries. It's estimated only about 5% of Cubans have access to the open internet, so there's a huge potential there.
Gold prices also fell sharply Monday to a new five-year low.
Traders are abandoning the precious metal because they're betting on the first U.S. interest rate hike in 9 years. Fed Chair Janet Yellen has signaled quite strongly that rates in the U.S. would start to rise possibly later this year because of the improving U.S. economy. And that sent commodities investors heading for the exits because most commodities are priced in U.S. dollars. And that makes them more expensive for overseas buyers when the dollar gains in value. And that's what we're seeing now.
VOA business reporter Alexis Christophorus in New York. Time now to turn to what's buzzing on social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is in the studio to tell us about two Twitter accounts you might want to follow in order to learn more about the normalization of ties between Washington and Havana. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray. It's a historic day for the United States and Cuba. And of course, America's top diplomat, John Kerry, was tweeting and retweeting a lot on Monday. His original tweets and retweets from the State Department's main Twitter accounts are in English. But he also shared tweets from the official Spanish language account of the State Department. He's on Twitter at John Kerry.
Oh, I see. Sort of. Tell us about his original tweets.
Sure. Kerry sent out three original tweets Monday, and the one that got the most attention is the first one. He wrote, "On August 14th, it will be my honor to raise the American flag at our embassy in Havana. Hashtag Cuba for the first time in 56 years. He ended a tweet with hashtag US Cuba. More than 1,900 people retweeted that, and it's also been marked as a favorite more than 2,000 times.
And what's been the reaction from the Cuban side so far?
It showed a similar sentiment. The Cuban embassy in the States is on Twitter at EmbaCubaUS, that's EmbaCubaUS. It actually changed the handle Monday and added a new description to reflect the embassy's reopening.
Are there any tweets coming out of that account?
Yes, there were two. One was announcing the handle change, like I just mentioned, and another one was a photo of Cuban officials visiting the embassy in D.C.
Before you go and wrap this all up, tell us about the trending hashtags on the issue, if any.
The social media analytics website Topsy shows that the hashtag US Cuba was used in more than 10,000 tweets in the last 24 hours. And as you know, Ray, Topsy is a certified Twitter partner that analyzes tweets. Back to you.
Well, you're absolutely right. I do know about that. Thanks, G, for the update. Social media reporter G. Abby Lee, and you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz, past and present, and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter is in Israel, the first leg of a Middle East trip aimed at strengthening American links with allies concerned about the new internationally negotiated Iranian nuclear accord. Upon his arrival Monday, Secretary Carter said Israel is the bedrock of American strategy. He'll meet today with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. VOA Scott Bobb in Jerusalem talked with International Edition Susan Yaki about the trip and what's expected.
It's the first trip by a cabinet-level official U.S. to Israel or to the Middle East since the Iran deal was announced almost a week ago. Clearly, it's meant to try to rebuild some frayed edges in the relationship between the United States and Israel, and to reassure the Israelis, and also to see how they can proceed to ensure that Israel is secure.
Well, the U.S. and Israel have long time been friends, and close friends at that. But Israel has come out strongly against this new Iran nuclear deal.
Not only strongly, but repeatedly. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has just taken every opportunity, every photo op with a visiting dignitary, every appearance locally or internationally to denounce this deal as a bad deal, and lately of historic proportions that paves the way for Iran to acquire nuclear weapons, and also by easing sanctions gives it billions of dollars of more funds to engage in terrorism. So he's very strong, and he's continuing that, and it's seems that he is trying to build up support in the United States, both public and especially in the U.S. Congress, which, of course, is to review and approve this deal.
Also on the Secretary's agenda is the ongoing fight against the Islamic State. Do we know how Israel stands on that?
Well, Israel is obviously very concerned, but is sort of staying publicly out of the fray as much as possible because it has reportedly some very backdoor, very almost secret connections with some of the more moderate Arab states about mutual security worries and how to address them. By coming out publicly and forcefully, it is feared that this obliges some of the allies on this issue for the moment, let's say, might have to publicly disavow, and some indeed have. So Israel does try to stay under the radar, but it is very concerned, especially about activity along its northern border with Lebanon and Syria, and to a lesser degree, but still nevertheless significant degree, with Egypt.
VOA Scott Bob in Jerusalem speaking with International Edition Susan Yaki. Debt-ridden Greece reopened its banks Monday for the first time in 3 weeks, while also increasing taxes and making critical loan payments to two of its international lenders. Depositors swarmed into banks to tap their accounts. 3-week-long restrictions are eased, but withdrawals remain limited. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras faces new parliamentary challenges this week as his administration seeks approval of reforms demanded by European creditors in exchange for more loans. While Greece struggles to survive its crippling economic crisis, campaigners say dozens of other countries, especially in the developing world, are building up dangerous levels of debt. Much of the money is lent by private investors looking for profits with the industry largely unregulated, as Henry Ridgewell explains.
Athens may be in the headlines, but campaigners say the potential is building for a full-blown debt crisis in many parts of the developing world. Tim Jones is from the Jubilee Debt Campaign.
There's a huge boom in lending happening, especially to some of the most impoverished countries in the world at the moment. So we're worried that unless action is taken, they could end up in new debt crises again.
Among the 20 countries described as most vulnerable to a debt crisis is Mozambique.
Its economy has been booming massively. It's had huge amounts of lending to the country, but actually poverty is increasing at the same time, and inequality is increasing. So the loans are not necessarily helping in tackling the problems of the country.
The Jubilee Debt Campaign says the total amount owed by debtor countries is due to hit $14.7 trillion this year, a 30% rise in 4 years. The group says 20 nations are already mired in debt crises, with many more vulnerable to economic turbulence. It's all tied to the recent financial crisis, says Judith Tyson of the Overseas Development Institute, speaking via Skype from Greece.
We've really seen a surge of debt being issued because of the search for yield, which is where investors in primarily in Europe and in the United States are looking for new investments because of the very low interest rates in our economies. And one of the places that they've invested large amounts of money is in sovereign debt in developing countries.
Other countries, particularly in Latin America, have been burdened with high debts for decades, says Jones.
If we take Jamaica, their debt crisis first began in the 1970s. And actually, since the 1990s, they've had huge government surpluses. But the debt has remained because the interest is just so high and the economy has been depressed in the attempt to pay these debts. And it just shows that you can't get out of a debt crisis by making cuts.
That is the argument put forward by the Greek government. But Europe, led by Germany, insists spending cuts and reforms are the only way to revive the economy. For indebted developing countries, there are additional risks.
There's a bigger problem is that the debts are all owed in foreign currencies, like the dollar or the euro. And so when a country has a currency devaluation, the debt payments shoot up.
As the debts grow, so do the risks.
And there's certainly very high-risk investments of the sort where we could see significant losses in the future.
Campaigners are calling for much tighter regulation of lending and debt write-offs for those countries already in crisis. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
If you're a cigarette smoker, you best listen up. Smoking's long been linked to many health problems, including lung cancer and heart disease. Now comes the real possibility of its association with schizophrenia, a severe mental disorder marked by delusional thoughts and hallucinations. VOA's Jessica Berman has details.
Cigarette smoking is very common among people with mental disorders, especially schizophrenia. It's something that Samir Johar, psychiatric researcher at King's College London, noticed.
As a psychiatrist, it's always something you think about, because you always see patients with psychotic illnesses smoking. People generally put it down to self-medication.
Johar made his comments in a podcast posted by the online journal The Lancet Psychiatry, which published his study of the relationship. Findings by the King's College team offer the intriguing notion that cigarette smoking may in some ways increase the risk of developing schizophrenia. The researchers analyzed 61 studies worldwide and found the tobacco habit is three times more common among schizophrenic patients coming to treatment for the first time compared to the general population. Approximately one quarter of people who live in Western countries are cigarette smokers. James McCabe is a senior study co-author and doctor of psychiatric research at King's College. He says the fact that more than half of schizophrenics smoke is not surprising. What the finding does challenge, he says, is the belief that people who suffer from psychosis are smoking to ease their symptoms.
If the explanation was self-medication, you would expect that when people started to develop schizophrenia, they would be no more likely to smoke than anybody else. And the smoking would then develop in response to the symptoms.
But the authors found people with schizophrenia started smoking at a younger age than other smokers before psychotic symptoms appeared. There is a suggestion, but not the findings to prove it, that nicotine stimulates production of the brain chemical dopamine. Dopamine helps control the brain's reward and pleasure centers. Increased levels have been observed in patients with psychosis, and medications to treat schizophrenia aim to reduce dopamine activity. If a definitive link is ever made between smoking and the development of schizophrenia, McCabe says patients at risk for the disorder due to family history or substance abuse might be well advised to kick the habit.
Now, there are many reasons why we should try to reduce rates of smoking in the population for physical health reasons, but this suggests that possibly doing so would also actually benefit people's mental health.
The authors are calling for more in-depth studies investigating the role of sporadic smoking and nicotine addiction in the development of psychotic disorders. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
American Zach Johnson is now a member of professional golf's elite. Johnson outlasted a crowded leaderboard, turbulent weather conditions, and a three-man playoff to win the 144th edition of the Open Championship on Monday at St. Andrews, Scotland. Johnson says it's been a humbling experience.
It was a test starting Thursday, certainly. The elements, you know, I mean, I can go on and on about this. I think I probably had the better end of the wave. I mean, I didn't hit a golf shot on the golf course on Saturday. Had a nice day off to relax, work out, et cetera. And then, you know, I didn't get off to a good start on the third round on Sunday, but I managed to make some birdies coming in, which was crucial just to get my round under par. And this bunch going into today, I felt like if I can get a little bit of momentum early on in the day, then who knows what's going to happen. And you know, I'm 7-under through 12 holes or whatever it was. I didn't think it'd be quite that significant, but, you know, I hit good shots. I had opportunity. I mean, I made some putts. I'm not going to deny that. I made one on two that really kick-started my day from probably 25 feet. Made one off the green on four. But, I mean, I missed a lot of 12 to 15-footer for eagle on the fifth hole and missed another about 12-footer on the sixth hole. So, you know, I played really solid. And put myself in a position to make birdies and make a run. I knew the guys in front of me, they're well accomplished, they're champions, they're not going to back down. I mean, I clearly had to be somewhat aggressive early on in the day because those outward holes are the ones you got to kind of take advantage of.
The British Open title is Johnson's 12th career PGA Tour victory and his second major, the first coming to the Masters in Augusta, Georgia in 2007. British singer Hannah Boleyn is about to release her first CD after making a splash in the United Kingdom. Boleyn's CD, called The Boleyn Affair, features emotional lyrics from a singer whose voice echoes other British stars such as Adele and the late Amy Winehouse. Here's International Edition's David Byrd.
Wrap me up in your arms, read the future in my palms. Tell me it will work out, my body is riddled with doubt.
Hannah Boleyn says she is fond of music she calls cinematic soul. Think the theme from Goldfinger or The Spy Who Loved Me. Big arrangements, big voices, female voices that showcase big emotions. The 25-year-old from Leicestershire, England, started her first band when she was in elementary school. Obsessed with the Spice Girls, her favorite one being Posh Spice, also known as Victoria Beckham, she formed a girl group of her own and performed original material for her classmates. Boleyn left home at 16 to go to a musical theater school, but found she didn't want to do other people's music her whole life. As her career path came into sharper focus, Hannah decided to record as an independent artist, something that has made her rise to success tougher.
I've had lots of friends and family, when you tell someone you're a singer, and they go, oh, got the X Factor. But for me, firstly, I love the writing process. That's a big part of it for me, and I want to have control of what I'm doing. And secondly, I don't think anyone would like me. So I wouldn't get any votes.
But she is getting noticed. After years of gigging with whoever would take her, Boleyn has found success supporting artists, including James Morrison, Joan Armatrading, and Tinny Tempa. In working on her debut CD,
that's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more stories, photos, sound, and video at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Iraqi government has announced it is leading a major military push to retake Iraq's Anbar province from ISIL, which controls two of the province's major cities, Ramadi and Fallujah. Clearing ISIL from Anbar is no easy task. As President Barack Obama recently noted, ISIL has dug in among innocent civilian populations in the urban areas under its control. But as local forces take on ISIL militarily, it is also important for ISIL sympathizers in Iraq, Syria, and beyond to hear the stories of those who were once attracted to the propaganda promulgated by ISIL, but who have come to reject it. As President Obama has said, to ultimately defeat terrorist groups like ISIL, it is necessary to discredit their ideology, the twisted thinking that draws vulnerable people into their ranks. Who can do that better than those who have seen it from the inside at close quarters? Take, for example, a former ISIL fighter from Fallujah known as Hamza, who volunteered to join ISIL last summer, but who defected after 6 months. He told the Independent newspaper he joined the group for religious reasons, but was appalled by the beheadings, by being asked to execute Sunnis whom he knew, and by being offered captured young Yazidi women for sexual pleasure. At the beginning, I thought they were fighting for Allah, but later I discovered they were far from the principles of Islam, he said. The justice they were calling for when they first arrived in Fallujah turned out to be only words. Or the Syrian teenager Youssef Barho, recruited by ISIL to be a suicide bomber, who eventually gave himself up to Iraqi authorities. He told the New York Times last year he joined ISIL willingly because he believed in Islam and had been convinced by ISIL that if he didn't join the group, Shiites would come and rape his mother. Soon, however, he said, I noticed things that were different from Islam. He noted, for example, that ISIL inflicted severe punishments on men in the city who were caught smoking cigarettes. Yet in camp, he saw fighters smoking. He witnessed homosexual encounters between the fighters, and he became increasingly disturbed by the killing of innocent people. President Obama has said that the international fight against ISIL is a battle against terrorists who distort Islam and whose victims are mostly Muslims. Those who have experienced ISIL firsthand and have turned away say the same.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.